You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
The March of 1991 was a turning point in India's history. The Chandrasekhar government presented an interim budget on the 4th of March. Finance Minister Yashwant Sinha spoke in the budget speech of a fragile economic situation and a macroeconomic crisis, but could not take corrective steps required because the government was politically too weak. By May 1991, international rating agencies had downgraded India to below investment grade. India was on the brink of default on its international obligations, something that had never happened before. Mr. Sinha authorized the State Bank of India to sell 20 tons of gold from the Government of India's stock to the Union Bank of Switzerland. He also authorized negotiations for pledging 47 tons of gold from the reserves as collateral for a loan of $600 million from the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England. They insisted that the gold should be physically shipped to their vaults in London. On 21st June 1991, a new government headed by P.V. Narasimha Rao was sworn in. It brought the crisis under control and reversed the economic policies of interventionism India had stuck to in the first four decades post-independence. These decisions changed the Indian economy unimaginably. Welcome to India's Reform Story. I'm your host Pooja Mehra. I'm an independent journalist and podcaster and the author of The Lost Decade, 2008-18, How India's Growth Story Devolved into Growth Without a Story. India's Reform Story is a seven-part podcast. In a series of seven conversations with economists, policymakers, and commentators, I will unpack the story behind India's reforms and find out what went on behind the scenes and how successive prime ministers, from Atal Bihari Vajpayee to Narendra Modi, have taken these reforms forward. In India, resistance to sound economics comes from all shades of the ideological spectrum. The left and the right usually obstruct reforms, taking very similar positions. Dr. Vijay Kelkar was finance secretary and earlier the petroleum secretary in Mr. Vajpayee's governments. He was also the chairman of the 13th Finance Commission. In his first tenure, Prime Minister Modi consulted Dr. Kelkar on a number of occasions on policy matters, including the GST. I asked Dr. Kelkar about Mr. Vajpayee's knack of overcoming resistance to reforms. Interestingly, Dr. Kelkar makes a point that is very different from the analysis offered by the other guest speakers on this podcast series. Dr. Kelkar told me that Mr. Vajpayee's reforms were different than the Dr. Manmohan Singh, P.V. Narasimha Rao deals because they were not crisis-driven. They were consensus-driven. And that's an alternative way of doing reforms.
He made contribution towards structural reforms, macroeconomic reforms, mesoeconomic reforms, institutional reforms, and microeconomic reforms. In other words, the gamut of changes we introduced within his period as prime minister. Remember, he had two innings of prime ministers. So I'm combining the two innings of prime minister together. So his contribution has been a very, very wide ranging. So let me start with kind of what were the sort of institutional reforms he made to start with. I think he really gave genuine contribution towards now what we call cooperative federalism. I mean, the way he resurrected the National Development Council, the way he engaged with the chief ministers and one of the incredible action he took in terms of, if you remember, when that government came into power, this is NDA, the global and domestic interest rates had declined sharply compared to earlier period. So all the state governments were burdened with the tax borrowings. I mean, the borrowings are very high interest rates, which the contract, because our contracts are essentially fixed interest contracts. So he could see there is an opportunity to reduce the interest rate burden. So if you remember, the government of India did this exchange, swapping of high interest, low interest rate swap. And the entire fiscal cost, which implied, was taken by central. So this was, to my mind, a sort of very excellent example. Dan Suomoto didn't. He did it because he felt that this is how he strengthened the. Similarly, he strengthened the, in my view, the Planning Commission by getting Mr. Kesi Pant to chair it. And he brought in a lot of sort of changes in the way the NDC functions. And so in the economic management, there was a genuine attempt to sort of strengthen cooperative federalism. Other the institutions which he created for better management of Indian economy, I'll mention two. One is Competition Commission. If you remember, Competition Commission came during his regime. He first requested Mr. Raghavan to chair a committee. with the Sudhir Mujji was a member when Sinhaji was a finance minister. Based on that, and Competition Commission, I think, in my view, major institutional innovation for promote competition in the economy. Similarly, National Statistical Commission. He realized that without knowledge, without data, you really can't run. So that was also came about. So after, my view, like Nehru, Nehru's contribution was like the institutions. Something similar happened in short span, much smaller span, in terms of economic management, I'm talking about, in his time. So the institutional innovation introduced. And of course, the macroeconomic reforms were really stunning. If you take the creation of fiscal responsible budget management, FRBM, idea that government ties his hand on fiscal. It was very unusual for any democratic governments. We initiated it. We realized that that's very important for India. Our second major macroeconomic reforms was essentially tax reforms, both direct and indirect taxes, which was essentially dramatically changed the what I call the cost of risk capital. And that really gave the investment boom in the intervening years. And other macro reform, which is not usually appreciated, is reducing interest rates, real interest rates, by cutting down, by linking small-scale savings interest rate, NSS, to market. With that, as otherwise, used to give the flow to all the interest rate structures in India. So that he cut out. So that was the basis for investment boom, which came about. The major macro reforms. And third is the what I call macroeconomic reform, which are the sector reform. The most classic were telecom sector and road sector. I mean, two of the most important ones, I would argue. And then, of course, number of other reforms related to microeconomics, like, for instance, in oil industry, removing the price controls, this kind of thing, which are really micro reforms. So he gave everywhere, all the areas of economic policies into the reform, which essentially was to promote competition, reduce cost of capital, and unleash the animal spirits of investors. And that laid the basis for the investment and boom in Indian growth rates, and really what I call became the golden age of growth. The other important concept he introduced, which is people don't really appreciate, and he was the one who also emphasized that. He also, I think, helped us change the labor of our distributive justice by calling is the policy of Antodaya. In other words, he said, look, I'm just going to focus the lowest rung. And in my view, it's quite reminiscent to me of, you must have seen the studies in Delhi school, John Rawls' theory of justice. And this is really the aspect, that the fair country, fairness is how you deal with the lowest rung of your, how to lift them up. So that's almost Rawlsian. So it's a different view than I think what others should take, in my view, which he explicitly mentioned. So these are the kind of, I think, the important ways he changed way managing our economy and unleashing the forces in Indian economy.
Dr. Kelkar, what you're saying is very important, because this shows that the reforms introduced by Mr. Vajpayee were sort of very rounded and multidimensional. And whereas there is this notion that India reforms only in times of crisis, you're saying that Mr. Vajpayee's government introduced reforms without there being crisis, and because it was determined to do two things. One, expand the market economy, allow market economy to function, and the various institutional and other changes required for that. And two, to make sure that those who cannot participate directly in the market, there was some redistributional scope for them. Is that, am I correct in understanding what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And after our nuclear testing, and when we declare India nuclear power, India became sort of a pariah amongst the powers of the world economy in the world. And we were facing sanctions. So we were revising how to sort of meet our challenges. So one of the things we remembered that in 1991 crisis, Japan was very forthcoming in supporting India. So Prime Minister and Finance Minister asked me to go to Japan. So I went to Japan. I met that time, it was what was called as Mr. Yen Sakakibara, was the finance secretary of Japanese finance secretary. I met foreign office and they were very polite, but they were quite firm, because for them, nuclear issue is extremely emotional because they were a victim of nuclear attack. I said, this is the first time Mr. Bajpayee is trying to introduce what I call not crisis-driven reforms, but the consensus-driven reforms. A completely new model he's introducing, which is not crisis-based, but consensus-based. And I also mentioned, I thought, I didn't realize I was so right in arguing that argument. I also mentioned to my Japanese host that if we want stability in India, it has to be based on tripod, stable tripod. Stable tripod means India, China, and Japan. He said, if one of the legs is weak, it will become unstable. So I thought I'd appeal to them politically. Also, but I must confess, the nuclear issue was too sensitive for them to make any. But they're upset. The reason I remember that, because this time I argued with my hosts that this time around our approach of what Mr. Bajpayee is trying to do is consensus-driven reform, not crisis-driven reform. We have so there's a greater commitment, internal commitment, towards reforms, not coming from anywhere else.
Do you think that consensus still holds? Are we seeing for ideological or other reasons, such as newer realities, that consensus weakening? Do you see it weakening?
No, what is weakening is a willingness to create consensus, to reach out, a genuine consultation, in reaching out the way he reached out all the sections of his coalition partners. And even he was very, very collegiate in running the government. I mean, you had the complete freedom once the policy decided for ministers like General Khanduri in surface transport, or Arun Shori in the area of privatization, or of course Mr. Sinha as the finance minister, Mr. Jaitley as corporate affairs and law minister, Jaswant Singh Ji, defense, Jaswant Singh Ji, foreign affairs, George Fernandez in defense. I mean, I can keep on going. So he's system also was collegiate. So that promoted consensus also within the different parties, and also reached out to everybody. And remember, he had problems internally with Swadeshi Jagran Manch. He tried to reach out, but he didn't want to compromise more than what is required. Ultimately, he said, I will go ahead with the reforms.
I was just going to come to that, because we find, you know, for preparation for this project, I was listening to a lot of speeches that he gave, especially on globalization and trade, and how he spoke to industry on industry platforms, saying that, you know, they cannot expect protectionism, whereas he was concerned that they should not get hurt by the trade-related measures that his government, reforms that his government was introducing. But he kept telling them that, you know, they could not, beyond a point, become over-dependent on protectionism. But we see now that there is a reversal of, you know, that thinking, whether for ideological reasons or for whatever reasons. And this is some bit also a global phenomenon. The global mood also has changed on globalization, etc. There, you know, how do you analyze the current situation, especially because you spoke of the Swadeshi Jagran Manch? Because in India, the Swadeshi Jagran Manch, the left, large sections of the Congress Party, they all seem to have very similar views on these issues.
I remember the Congress Party has a problem, but SJM is, Swadeshi Jagran Manch is still very protectionist. And it was similar with Bajpayee. Bajpayee had to fight them politically with them on the line. And he won his line.
So when we speak of a reformist approach, what is the lessons to be taken from Mr. Bajpayee's tenure in handling these issues? Because we are not able to do it anymore, it looks like.
I think he linked international politics and domestic economy much better. If you want to be a great economic power in the world, you can't be protectionist. You have to engage with the world. You can't. Traffic has to be two-way with the world. And he understood the link between being a great, if you want to become great political power, you have to become great economic power. And without trade and investment, you cannot do that. And which has to be both ways. So he saw the link between politics and economy much better than many of us.
Could you say something about the taxation reforms by successive governments, including GST and, you know, all the other reforms?
You see, if you remember, when I came back from Washington, Jaswant Singh was finance minister. And he asked me what you want me to do. I said, look, I'll be very happy to work if you work on both direct and indirect tax reforms. And we had a terrific, very independent experts group. And we proposed essentially two ideas: is reduce the overall tax rate and eliminate the sectional base, the sort of concessions or tax relief. So that was a trade-off. You reduce the rate overall, but then you get rid of... And the argument was very simple. The reason it went through with the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister, I said, look, this is the way you're going to reduce the cost of risk capital to our industry. If you want to increase investments, you must reduce the cost of capital. We already done through interest rates, debt capital. But the real cost is the people take risks. Risk capital is too high. We calculated and showed to them, it's 45% of the highest in the world. The incidence on almost reaching 50%. Nowhere going to invest. It's 50% tax on the risk taking. So he accepted that. And it went through. So in that tax, and plus, we did a lot of administrative reform. Essentially, it was a 3-point mantra for diet tax reform. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. So get rid of these annexures and everything. And that appealed to both the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister. That's what I think. He was very much liked it. I remember he was really, he said, So he was quite keen on this. So diet tax reform was based on these two principles, simplicity, simplicity, and reduce the cost of risk capital. And indirect tax reform was, we were just lucky. What happened was, you know, when we got a constitution, Pooja, our constitution makers gave rights to tax agriculture to states and industry to central government. They didn't mention anything about services. What they said, what was not mentioned is distributive powers came with the center. So central government service sector was expanding. So tax base was expanding. But we had no clarity. So that's one thing the finance minister said, look, this is not correct. Let's get constitutional amendment and get this right for center to tax services sector. So there's no, I don't want to do it by default. So introduce this. That time, our committee was going on. And Arvind Modi was working with us that time, and Ajay Shah. And suddenly thought occurred to us, oh my God, if it's going to come in, why not we make it as a combined taxes together? And this is a bargain we can make to the state governments, with the state. And we are going to give you new areas of taxation. Because till then, service only taxed by India, for central government. So I said, that's a good gesture of cooperative federalism, which will say that the tax base for you and central will be the same. In exchange, let's harmonize it by a single rate called GST. So it was what we call grand bargain with the states, that state got a much enlarged power to the state. Through this, state other access. State will also got access to the tax base from GST on imports. Till then, the countervailing duty was only given to center. So I said, you're also getting this, but a bargain would be, we come together and share it, equal tax base and have single. And that's how India becomes single market. And we also argued, because of our taxing structure, two things are happening. In India, manufacturing sector is overtaxed and exports are overtaxed because there's no reimbursement of taxes. The reason we're not exporting enough, not because we're stupid, our fiscal policy was designed against exports. Manufacturing sector was slow because it was entire tax burden went on manufacturing sector. So naturally, you would have, as economists, you would have argued correctly that people will shift to non-tax sector. But that's why services was booming and the manufacturing sector was declining. So GST basically will completely remove this bias against the manufacturing sector. It will be, India will become single market and exports will boom. And naturally, it's built with Mr. Bajpayee and just one thing. The idea of one tax, one nation, common market, which has not happened so far. If that's happened, it also appeal to their those patriotic instinct also. That this is the right thing to do. And finally, government fell. I mean, but to credit to Chidambaram, because I still continued for 4 months to work with advisor. I met Chidambaram, made a presentation. He also came on board. If you remember, in that budget, he announced 2010 GST will be introduced. So there was a buy-in by national parties. Not the local parties, that's my national parties understood as a representative of national bourgeoisie. They understood the interest of bourgeoisie in this and also interest for the country and interest of everybody, especially export. I'm more interested, personal interest was we were just not exporting enough manufacturers. And I realized it's a structural problem, not because of is our tax structure. So that was the origin of GST. And it took a long time, but then we have to involve fairness. All federal countries have taken a decade to implement GST. Australia, Brazil, EU, Canada. So India taking 1 decade is not that out of sort of line of than other countries. We could have done faster, but it's not very unusual also. So, but mistake was done by not doing it simplified as we were proposing. But that will come later on. That was not Mr. Bajpai's problem. But if had Bajpai would have continued that, I assure you, would have got absolute model GST. He would have negotiated personally with the chief minister.
Are you saying, in other words, that Mr. Modi failed to do that?
No, because he didn't persuade the chief ministers.
Lost opportunity.
Also, Jaitley was a beautiful negotiator, but he was still a finance minister. To persuade chief ministers, prime minister, if Harry put his weight behind Jaitley, I think he would have found a different GST.
Right. Do you have any idea of why Mr. Modi did not himself get involved with this negotiation with the state chief
minister? I met only a couple of times on this issue. But I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. He listened to me, all fairness. He gave me a full hearing. I explained to him my simple formula. And once it was a meeting in front of former Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore. If you remember, he had organized a meeting where Nitya invited this former Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore to give a lecture to entire cabinet, including Prime Minister. After that, he asked me to comment on that. So everybody was sitting there. Same point I made on single rate. I said, one country, one tax, one rate. And the Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore publicly endorsed, he said, this is the right thing to do, this is what we are doing. So, I had an opportunity twice to talk to him, but I can't explain why he didn't put his weight behind Jaitley.
One reform where he did put his weight behind Mr. Jaitley is, the rollout of the monetary policy framework designed by the Dr. Urjit Patel Committee. Many people don't understand why this is a very important reform. You've written in your book, it's the most important milestone in the RBI's history. Could you please explain why this is important? Also because it has links with fiscal policy and, your own FRBM reform.
Important is that first is a clear separation of accountability and responsibility of monetary policy tools and fiscal policy tools. And second, make it rule-based. And third, it is the reform not gone far enough, but I think over time we'll go further. Because earlier proposal was more balanced voting power in MPC. But now it's not yet happened, but it will happen in future. But it's giving predictability of the system. And what investors or any economic agents like wanted predictability of and remember you were taught at Delhi school the critical insight of Professor Tinbergen of assignment problem. One target, one instrument. Don't put too many objectives on one policy instrument. And to give that clarity, and I think given our stage of development, I thought it very important for me.
You've also written in your book that intensification of this strategy behind the reforms until now can no longer be relied upon for delivering growth and development, and fresh thinking is needed. Could you say what sort of direction we need to take now?
I think two or three areas. One is the institution building. Institutions we have neglected. Ultimately, decisions get negotiated through the institutions. And we did nothing on strengthening institutions. And corollary of that, we did very little in capacity building. I'm currently reading a book on China. And in China, one of the important things I was not aware, Deng Xiaoping did a lot of emphasis on strengthening the state capacity. That, I think, we have neglected state capacity. And third, I think more of the same will not work, is a very great challenge of urbanization. The third tier. Strengthening of third tier, because most of our local public goods are going to be important. And that's where I think we are not thought through in our first 91 reforms or later on reforms or even so far. Is a new frontier is coming up that revolves around capacity in institutions in the third tier.
So earlier there was intellectual consensus, but the constraint was the politics. As of today, do you see intellectual consensus or even any intellectual inputs available for the politics to come around to it? Or both are constraints?
No, I don't think there's still intellectual consensus. There's turmoil.
Is that why we are seeing reforms slowing down?
I mean, that's because it's because reforms are not taking place. I'm just conjecturing that must be the one reason. Because in some respect, correct me if I'm wrong, our book must have been one of the first few ones which brings up this new paradigm requirement. So I'm sure there will be many more. And I think especially this very brutal attack of India by China is going to awaken us. Maybe that will speed up the building of consensus, because the Chinese challenge has to be responded very, very thoughtfully and strategically. So that we may, 91 crisis, like this also crisis, a different kind, but very important challenge India has.
Dr. Kelko made two very interesting points. One, he seems to suggest that Mr. Modi has not been as successful as Mr. Vajpayee in building consensus and taking everyone along on the path of reforms. It is not enough to roll out reforms. For reforms to be durable, everyone must feel reassured their concerns were taken on board and decisions were not unilaterally forced upon them by a brute majority. Second, listening to a wider range of people only helps decision makers be better informed and the quality of decisions improves. Mr. Vajpayee knew the value in this.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.